It is time for the Media Beat from David Tereshchuk, his weekly review of media coverage for Robinhood Radio and exclusive to Robinhood Radio. David is a multimedia and international journalist with his own online column at themediabeat.us. And as a special correspondent since 2012, he has contributed TV reports to the PBS network, mostly on ethical issues. Here's David.
Hello, this is David Tereshchuk reporting in from the media capital of the world, New York City, with the Media Beat for the weekend beginning October 20th, 2023. The current Middle East war is being brought home to us by reporters. I'm deliberately evoking here a phrase very common in newsrooms, and for a time, bringing it home was an everyday mission slogan for me and my fellow teachers at Columbia University's Graduate School of Journalism. We inculcated our classes of budding reporters with the various meanings that bringing it home could signify. It can simply mean, in a general metaphorical sense, emphasizing a point so as to achieve clear comprehension and recognition. Sometimes, if we're lucky, it means a piece of reporting breaks through barriers of apathy or prejudice, even complete polarization of opinion. That's harder and harder to achieve in today's world of intolerantly divided factions and echo chamber media audiences. But the phrase bringing it home has also been used more specifically then and now in many newsrooms for overseas news. And here it carries a more literal meaning. Bringing overseas news home to American audiences is regarded as especially challenging, since Americans in general are not characterized by a great capacity for embracing the wider world. And that's especially true with reporting a war. War and overseas can, to many American ears, sound like some blurring of overlapping subjects. Our labels and titles in this field are very illustrative. Not many countries in the world would, like America, choose to name an association for retired soldiers veterans of foreign wars. For Americans, since our own Civil War marks the last time military hostilities took place on our own soil a century and a half ago, war is seemingly almost by definition something that happens abroad. That does not apply, obviously, to many other countries around the globe who are all too familiar with wars on their own doorstep. By the way, this kind of American exceptionalism led the New York Times to create a front-page headline that stands out preeminently in our profession's institutional memory, published on the day after the World Trade Center's destruction on 9/11. "United States attacked," it said boldly, emphasizing the event's singularity. So with the current war 6,000 miles away, how well or otherwise are U.S. journalists bringing home the war's true nature and its full significance? Bringing it home to America's living rooms, its desktop computers, the smartphone's screen and its earbuds. In the second full week of the Israel versus Hamas bloodshed, most homegrown media here have turned to what are decidedly American angles and dimensions of that war. News desks got a huge assist in this with the United States president deciding to visit the war zone in person. That's unquestionably a big story, much bigger even than when the Secretary of State, Tony Blinken, undertook his frenetic tour of Israel and neighboring Arab countries. It was so fast and hurriedly changing that diplomatic reporters and Blinken's accompanying entourage called it unusually chaotic. That pool of correspondents saw Blinken hear the news of the terrible blast at Gaza's Al-Ahli Arab Hospital just as he was having dinner with Jordan's King Abdullah. As we now know, the explosion killed over 500 patients and people sheltering in the hospital grounds. Almost no time elapsed before the head of the Palestinian Authority, Mahmoud Abbas, cancelled his planned meeting in Jordan with the king, the U.S. president, and Egypt's President al-Sisi. His cancellation was, he made clear, in protest against Israel having bombed the hospital. It wasn't long before the king cancelled the entire four-way Arab summit. And meanwhile, Israel cited their own intelligence sources to blame another group entirely, Islamic Jihad, which sometimes allies itself with Hamas, for causing the hospital massacre by, quote, misfiring a rocket. Journalists working the story were quick to point out that Israeli intelligence sources lack some credibility now in the wake of them not knowing anything about the original Hamas attack on October the 7th. All this agreeing and then cancelling, fixing, but then rescheduling did underscore the sense of chaos. Now, President Joe Biden and his media managers don't do chaos, or try very hard not to. It's the very opposite of the Biden brand. He embarked on the trip with the intent of treading a careful line, even while expressing traditional U.S. solidarity with Israel. His media advisors would have been on guard to resist the kind of political image polishing that the embattled Benjamin Netanyahu was undoubtedly hoping for. A photo op with Biden and Bibi together, with an Israeli tank as the backdrop perhaps to signify fortitude, would have been high on Tel Aviv's wish list when the Prime Minister's invitation was first sent to the White House. But looking in the Arab direction, it turned out to be virtually impossible to present America as even-handed toward the Arab side, when there was suddenly no one really to talk to at the top level, certainly not in person. In this regard, Biden wasn't helped by his own statement voiced while sitting alongside Netanyahu about the Gaza hospital bombing, and I'll quote his oddly flippant words. "Based on what I've seen, it appears as though it was done by the other team, not you." Though he did go on to admit lamely, reading from his notes, that there's a lot of people out there who are not sure. Taking Mideast media coverage in the round, there are many reasons to expect some strong audience engagement with the Middle East conflict. My hometown of New York, this avowed media capital of the world, can famously boast the largest Jewish community in the whole world outside of Israel. Equally famously, the Jewish lobby is among the strongest at work in the corridors of power in Washington. And it has some actual embodiment in the lobbying organization that's based in the nation's capital, carrying the witty name J Street. It's a play on K Street, the traditional home neighborhood of lobbyists in the Federal District. There's no physical J Street. It would apparently look too much like an I on street signs. J Street, the lobbying group, describes itself as pro-Israel and pro-peace, and in its public media outreach and its less public political work, it concentrates on the Democratic Party, while the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, APAC, mainly targets the Republicans. And whichever party has been in power, successive U.S. administrations have undoubtedly given strong diplomatic and military support to Israel ever since the country's creation 75 years ago. The only slight wavering, perhaps, and that mainly in tone rather than substance, came with Barack Obama's cooler, more dispassionate view of Israel in the matters of Palestinian rights and finding an effective policy toward Iran. America's position then was inevitably colored by the distinct and personally prickly antagonism that existed one-on-one between the president and Prime Minister Netanyahu. The fact remains that Israel has long been the biggest recipient in the world of American aid, currently totaling more than $300 billion since aid began. That's nearly twice what's been spent on assisting Israel's neighbor, Egypt, and more than twice what was spent on Afghanistan during that long involvement. It means, incidentally, that nearly a fifth of Israel's military budget comes from the United States public coffers. Part of the American media's ongoing job is, of course, to remind us as U.S. taxpayers that Congress is meant to control the public purse strings, and currently it's a purely domestic story that looms large and complicates the reporting of America's position on the Mideast conflict. And what a complication it has been. Rather than being energized during this stirring, challenging international crisis, Congress, or specifically the U.S. House of Representatives, was instead dramatically paralyzed. The absence of a Speaker of the House instantly stymied more military aid for Ukraine, and while the House's squabbling Republican majority may well be a lot more eager to rush assistance to Israel, The House has remained hamstrung at the very time its decision-making and action-taking has been sorely needed on the world stage. And not only the world stage, I should add, since I too have to bear in mind the bringing it home imperative, that I don't think it's too cynical, too much like a Capitol Hill reporter sniffing out pork barrel politics, to highlight one practical consequence of our government's overseas aid packages, one that few mass media correspondents have been highlighting this week. The fact is, when Congress does agree to a spending package for military assistance in foreign wars, much of the money goes to U.S. defense contractors, arms manufacturers. They end up enjoying the good fortune of selling yet more equipment to the U.S. military, weapon systems and ammunition, to replace what's being sent overseas to, in this case, either Ukraine or Israel. It would be good to see some detailed reporting on that when new enabling legislation starts to emerge finally from the House. Currently, Time magazine is already reporting that roughly $2 billion in supplementary funding can be expected. When it comes to bringing matters down to earth, down to a human scale, to a level where an individual news consumer can relate to another human being's individual experience, there can be little to match one domestic story that was horribly fueled by the Middle East's seemingly distant war. I mean inescapably the case of Wadia Al-Fayoumi, the 6-year-old Palestinian-American boy who was killed in Will County, Illinois, stabbed to death 26 times. His 32-year-old mother, Hanan Shahin, also received a dozen stab wounds, but mercifully she lived. The perpetrator was allegedly the family's landlord, Joseph Chuba, who was charged with first-degree murder, attempted first-degree murder, two counts of a hate crime, and aggravated battery with a deadly weapon. A statement to the press from the county sheriff's office, inevitably taken up by social media worldwide, was freighted with some unpolished, baleful phrasing. Detectives were able to determine that both victims in this brutal attack were targeted by the suspect due to them being Muslim, and the ongoing Middle Eastern conflict involving Hamas and the Israelis. A wholly, cruelly unwanted form of bringing it home. That's all from the Media Beat this week. Next week, I'll be reporting from overseas. I hope you'll listen then.
Thank you very much, David. We will talk to you next week. David can be found at themediabeat.us.